Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan.
Wait, are we back? Are we recording again?
I hope you're recording. I'm talking. You're in charge of recording.
Well, we are recording again. Sorry, folks that were listening or trying to listen to the podcast last week. We are human beings and apparently need vacation and it's just our vacations ended up lining up this time. Sometimes we're able to work it out so we have like a guest host or something like that, but this time I guess we both just needed the time off.
Yeah, vacations are good. You should take one. The
What was
listener,
that?
not you, Alan. You just took one.
Oh man.
Although I could totally go for another one.
Yeah, right. I mean, I wouldn't mind. I mean, I was in Hawaii, humble brag. I guess that's just a brag.
We kind of went two different directions. I mean, you went to Hawaii where it's nice and warm and sunny, and I went to Lake Tahoe where it was snowing. But avoided the snow entirely.
Not bad. Yeah, Hawaii was fun. I mean, I went to the island of Kauai, where I've never been before. I've been to Maui twice and the Big Island like three times. I really enjoy the Big Island, but I'd always heard so many things about how Kauai is beautiful and it's so much hiking, and I found that the I don't know, maybe it's just because it was raining whenever we were hiking. It was not as
Well,
beautiful as it could have been.
I mean, you got to go to Jurassic Park. You went to the real Isla Nublar.
Right. I think it's a bummer that I think something like 3 years ago or 2 years ago they took down the gates. But those were a big tourist attraction for people, which I can only I The only reason I can see they took them down was because they were probably a safety hazard.
Oh.
Because they weren't probably made to be like actual gates, so people were probably climbing on them or whatever. And so,
Or they got knocked down by the dinosaurs.
I could go with that. That'd be
Those are
okay.
real, right? That's my favorite documentary, Jurassic Park.
That part about the genetics lesson was awesome.
Yeah. Nature finds a way to knock down your gates, apparently. Oh, speaking of Hawaii, I know this isn't on the docket, but I saw an article that had the Yelp reviews of the top restaurants in America.
Yes.
And number one is one of my favorite restaurants that we have been to, De Poke Shack on the Big Island.
Oh, absolutely. That place is awesome.
So good. I was very surprised. Like, hey, wait a minute. Number one, I've been there.
Numerous times.
Yeah, that's how good it was. I mean, you go multiple times in a week.
That's one of those great kind of it fits that niche so well. I mean, for those that aren't familiar, it's essentially like a walk-up counter, like a deli counter. But instead of being like deli meats, it's like sushi grade fish because it's been caught that day. And some of the things that you can make out of that, which is poke, so that's tuna and avocado and seaweed and a little bit of oil, kind of. Oh God, that sounds so good right now.
Right? Well,
Yeah,
it
they
really
sell
lives
it.
up to its name. It's
Yeah,
De Poke Shack. It's a
right.
shack that sells pokey.
Yeah, and
That's it.
it's pretty simple, but there really isn't other stuff like that really on the island. I mean, a lot of the markets are kind of big box markets, like Lucky's or Safeway. I mean, there's a bunch of ABC stores, but those are not places that you'd get like food to eat. They're places you'd go to get like snacks or tchotchkes or whatever. And so I think it fits a really good niche, and they do really decent business, and they are cheap, and it's in a pretty
And you can
good
get
location.
beer.
Yes. So when I was on Kauai, I made it my mission, that was actually a thing, like, let's go find a place like De Poke Shack. And we found one. It's so if you're ever on Kauai, on the south end of the island, the Kaloa Fish Market is good. I mean, it's the same kind of setup where they have just like this one counter and a bunch of sushi and poke in like little tubs that you can, you know, they'll measure out and then sell you. Completely cash business. You know, they'll do plate lunches too. It was just a nice kind of place. But it was weird because in looking around, it seemed like that, again, like it was on the Big Island, it's the only place that was like that. And, you know, I mean, even not like that as in that's what they sold, but like that as in small business and, you know, tourist friendly, but also this is where the locals go kind of a place. There was one other market that had a kind of, I mean, they call themselves a juice bar, but it was literally like two mixers and a juicer. And it was good. So Aloha Aina. I think the thing that I loved was they had a wellness shot, which is not a shot. It's like a 12-ounce like cup. I don't know why they call it a shot, but the ingredients were essentially apple juice, apples that have been, so apple, the juice is from apples that they juice live, and then it had ginger, garlic, and cayenne pepper, which was very surprisingly good. Like that and some lemon, and I don't know, it A, clears your sinuses, and B, you feel invincible like after having it.
So like beer without the hangover.
Well, I don't know. I think my stomach may have been a little bit upset like later. So
it's so like beer, but
yeah. Oh, beer on the island. That ended up being a lot better than I expected. So there are two breweries on the island. There's and it's very confusing because it's Kauai Island Brewing Company and Kauai Brewing Company.
They really stretch the imagination with those names.
Yeah, but the best beers for sure were from the Kauai Island Brewing Company, which is in Port Allen. That one's kind of on the south end of the island as well. Their best one is their Lily Koi beer, which is a passion fruit kind of ale. That one was nice. And then the Kauai Brewing Company. That one's in, what is that?
Kauai.
Kapa'a, which is near the airport. Or Lihue, sorry. Lihue is the airport. And that one, theirs is called the Black Limo. And it's a, it's interesting because all of their beers, except for one, don't have kind of like Hawaiian sounding names. They don't do the kind of, you know, like Howley Ale or something like that. it's pretty, like, I think the brewers are like, you know, mainland expats or something. So, the best one they did was Black Limo, which was a porter, which was super nice. Just very, very creamy, which was unexpected and good. But they're only a tap room, so they don't have food or anything yet. They're still kind of working stuff out. But the Kauai Island Brewing Company, that one was nice because it did feel like a place where the locals were. It wasn't as sports bar like as a couple other places that I went that I just won't mention. There was one place that I didn't go to, but the reason that probably the main reason I didn't go to it was that it was advertised as a sports bar, and we'd found it on Yelp as like, oh, we'll go here, and we walked down to it from wherever we were. It was one of the few places within walking distance. And when we got to it, we immediately wrote it off because the storefront was just these huge numbers in the windows. And it took me a little bit to figure out what was going on. And they were numbers like the numbers on NASCAR cars.
Oh.
And then they had, you know, blah, 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 welcomes NASCAR fans. And I'm like, this is a little too specific. Like sports bar, I get NASCAR bar.
If you're calling NASCAR a sport, then come on.
Yeah, but for the most part, the island of Kauai, pretty nice. I think if it were a little, it's funny because I want to say if it were a little less rainy, but it's actually the island that gets the most rain. It gets something like 400 inches a year or some crazy number like that. So it's the Garden Isle, so it obviously gets a lot of rain. It is pretty. It's nice. I mean, it's Hawaii. You're not going to lose for the most part.
Right. How would you say the beer on that island stacks up against Kona Brewing?
So I definitely have to go back to Kona Brewing and check it out again, because Kona Brewing Company tastes so good on the island, and they brew their beer for the islands on the Big Island. But for everywhere else, including bottled beer and kegged beer that you get on the mainland, that comes out of, I think it's Oregon.
Yeah, it's Oregon.
And it is not the same. It's just not.
No.
So I think, you know, just remembering it, I'm going to give the edge to Kona Brewing Company. But, you know, that being said, the beer on Kauai was pretty nice when you could find a place that was serving, like, beer from the islands. It was weird. I went to two different bars, and they would have one beer from the island, and then the rest of it would be like Bud, Coors, blah 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 blah. And I'm like, really? you have Maui Brewing Company in Maui, Kona Brewing Company on the Big Island. You have two breweries in Kauai, and those are just the ones that I know. You know, make it outside of like the kind of sphere of influence that's there. I mean, there's got to be small places too that are brewing stuff, and I just found it really surprising. There was only one bar, and this was also in Lihue. It's called the Feral Pig, and it was an Irish bar. So very randomly, so every other Sunday they have an Irish band play. And I think that's hilarious. But it was the only bar we went to that had multiple breweries from the islands in their tap list. So not bad. I think that's the high points for drinking on the island of Kauai. Yeah, my vacation priorities can sometimes skew in that direction. So.
Well, you know, birds of a feather. I'll say Tahoe was fun. We did not quite make it to the snow.
But you kept warm.
But we kept warm.
I will say one thing, and this is just kind of an observation that I've had about places recently when I visit, is that I when I'm there for more than a couple days, I will kind of rate them on how hard or easy it would be to live there. And I think Kauai was hard because it really felt like I was visiting. Like even when I went to that market and was able to get lunch and kind of work it out, I just felt like it wasn't an island that I would want to kind of live on necessarily. Whereas on the Big Island, I feel like, you know, I knew my way around for the most part. I knew where, you know, the good food was. And it just felt more like just welcoming as a place to live. And so I'm not sure if there's something to be said for that. But that was my feel for Kauai. But the downside to being at a place where you visit all the time is that there are other people that visit too. And so there were a lot of tourists that I would run into. And I just felt like I felt more bombarded by tourists than I would on the Big Island. Like, I would feel like I would run into more locals and or whatever. But one interesting thing about the Big Island, or about Kauai, is the people that go to resorts tend to be couples, because that's how, you know, people vacation a lot. And I'm not sure if this is a problem with the resort I was at, but let's just say the walls were maybe a little too thin. It was a little noisy the first night there. And it was very kind of odd, and it's like a little awkward, maybe, you know, what do you do when the, people next to you are getting a little too friendly? You know, and, you know, thankfully, it's over relatively quickly. Maybe not too thankfully for her, but anyway, what was really funny was not the next day. It may not have been right away, but because we were there for 6 days, and maybe that was kind of towards the beginning of the trip, and then it was kind of quiet in the middle, or we weren't around when it was happening the rest of the time. But towards the end of the trip, maybe the second to last night or whatever, we were hearing people next door again, but they're not, or let's just say they were arguing. There was more of a disagreement kind of tone going on, and I like to think that the people who were there at the end of the trip were not necessarily the people at the beginning of the trip, because if you start there and you move towards arguing, you're not having a good vacation. But anyway, so that was the major part of the trip. But I was actually back in time for us to record, or roughly in time for us to record for that week. But then you went to Tahoe, so that's why we didn't have one last week. So sorry, everybody.
I make no apologies. I'm a man, not a machine.
Yeah, it's a free show, and for the most part, we really enjoy doing it every week, and we'll continue to. So,
we'll double up some week.
Oh, probably.
Or have some sort of specialized episode or something.
Sure. And if you'd like to help us with a specialized episode, let us know. Drop us a line on the website or tweet at us, however it works on these internets these days. Especially if you work for Specialized. I really, really like my new bike. But if you have a better bike that I should ride, please let me know. We are always looking for sponsors. But one other cool thing that that Julie and I did at the end of the week, and I don't know if we talked about this on the show or not, but we did a class in San Francisco called The Art of Escape. It's put on by Rift Recon, which is a kind of security and it's a security consulting company, and they do stuff like physical security penetration testing for banks or corporations or other secure facilities. And they say, okay, well, can people break into these buildings, whether they're, you know, physically doing it or electronically now? Apparently they also do consulting around that. But they were doing a class specifically about the scenario is you're in San Francisco when there's some kind of mass hysteria causing event, like an earthquake, or, you know, the Giants lose, or or something that causes, you know, enough panic that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily want to be out on the streets for some long period of time. And so your job is to escape from San Francisco. And what kind of skills do you need? What is your mindset that you need? What kind of preparation would you have to do beforehand? And it was taught in part by a guy that that we had taken a lockpicking class from it was at like a tech shop or something. It was just like a one day like 3 hour, let's pick locks and kind of have fun doing it. And that was kind of cool. And so I'd been following him on Twitter. Eric Michaud is his name. And I'd seen that he had put together this security consulting company, and they had opened a web store, and they had this great article written up on sfist.com. And it looked really neat, and we joined it. And I think it was really good. I mean, it was 3 days. It was taught by him and a guy who was, I guess, either a military contractor or ex-military guy who's also like a sheriff, a current cop. And it was all stuff like stuff that he had put together from being in more kind of hostile situations. And so there was a lot of stuff that was very kind of interesting, and had some crossover, like kidnap avoidance or lockpicking or escaping handcuffs or flexicuffs. And this is all taught from a, like, you know, you're in the thick of it, and this is a bad situation, and so these are skills to get out of it. And there were other things like what to pack on your person, kind of in a regular basis. So, like, you should have like some amount, obviously you should have like an ID and money, but maybe a flashlight, maybe a multi-tool. And then there was kind of like, okay, that's your first line. So your second line is, you know, a backpack with like a change of shoes and a jacket and rain gear, you know, fairly practical stuff. I think one of the issues was that I think it was good overall. There was a lot of good skills and stuff. I mean, I was able to break out of flexicuffs using, you know, essentially shoelaces. That was pretty cool. What you do is if you're cuffed, you would undo one of your shoelaces, loop it around both feet essentially, but through the cuff. And then you essentially saw your way out. And most shoelaces, at least on like kind of hiking boots, are sturdy enough to do that for like the cheaper zip ties. But if you want something that'll cut through kind of hardier stuff, they were like recommending, yeah, just go buy 550 paracord and change all your laces out for that. And it's like, oh, well, that's interesting and kind of a cool skill and fun, but I think some of the class itself was a little kind of oddly paced. Like, it was hard to tell when something was like, here's a neat skill to have, and here's a neat skill that you should probably only use in those emergencies. So there was a little bit of a kind of what I think is a timing and pacing problem with it. And so it was hard to internalize the right things while you were going. Like picking your way out of handcuffs is a fun skill and kind of cool, but it was hard to visualize like when you would use that. And because it was one of the first things they taught, it kind of felt like it was, oh, well, so this is like a fundamental skill and I'm having so much trouble with it and I don't know what to do. And so it kind of messed up the rest of the day for how it was going to go. But I think as a skills class, there's a lot of skills that are there that are really cool. As a mindset class, it really doesn't kind of fit the bill. It's too kind of all over. But if you ever want to pick up how to pick locks or get out of handcuffs, you let me know.
So you're now cop proof.
So see, that was one of the things. It's like, these are skills that, or at least the skills that they were teaching were kind of what I consider gray, like a little bit like, I don't know if I would use this against an actual assailant, you know, seemed a little suspect. But then one of the things they did was they would pepper it with, like, in most kind of kidnappings, the thing that was most commonly used to restrain people is like telephone or Ethernet wire. And it's just because it's all over the place. It's very easy to get. And that was one of the things that was, you can also, you know, kind of fairly easily saw out of, if assuming you have the wherewithal to do that, and you have a strong enough set of shoelaces or whatever, it was doable. That was one of the things that I did during the class. And that's like, okay, that's an interesting fact, and that's an interesting way of escaping it. But I think, you know, it's like you don't, I don't know, the hardest thing, and Julie agrees with me on this one, was that you don't want to promote a culture of fear. And I feel like that was one of the tactics that they were using to kind of instill. This is why it's important to learn this, but I don't want to live my life like constantly, you know, thinking I have to keep handcuff keys on me or something like that. So
no, you should swallow them. And just keep them in your system at all times.
Yeah.
Just every morning with your vitamins, take a handcuff key.
It's a small price to pay for your eventual freedom.
Yeah. Your digestive system will hate you, but totally worth it.
So I think it was a pretty good class. I think the one of the more kind of interesting things that that they talked about was the idea of kind of caching things and placing things away. I mean, and they talked about it in the class as like maybe you can put things in the city or in your area that you're normally in as things that you can get to. So like put lockpicks and a little bit of cash kind of wrapped up in a bundle near your place of business in a place that would not be disturbed. So if you had to escape and you had to leave your place of business, you could go pick that up and you would have kind of stuff along the way. And I think that might be maybe a little extreme, but one of the things that came out of it, which was very like usable and applicable, is if there are people that you know that are on your way out of town, essentially, ask to leave like a backpack at their house with like, you know, first aid and a little cash and some stuff.
An ammo.
Yes, exactly. So yeah. Yeah, there was some practical things that worked and some things that didn't, and I think it was very hard to discern that, and so I'm giving that to them as kind of feedback for how it goes. But it was interesting. I think the nicest thing was there was some diversity in the class. I was worried that it was going to be just like survival guys, and there were a few of those guys that were like, you know, they're literally wearing the camouflage windbreakers, right? You know,
listen, brother, when it hits the fan, what you got to know is
that there was a bit of doomsday prepper in some of those folks. And I think that, you know, obviously given the scope of the class that was kind of set up, it does feel like, you know, those type of people would work well. Although I think adapting it for a more urban kind of setting is necessary. And they tried to do that to some degree, but I think they needed a little bit of work on it. Like, they didn't do enough about kind of foraging in an urban environment for things. I think there's a lot of things that can be made into other things, you know, weapons mainly, but tools as well, right?
Ammo can be turned into anything because you can get anything with ammunition.
Well, you know, given
it's a multi-purpose resource,
given a delivery mechanism for that ammunition, you can probably get absolutely anything.
Exactly. Like, I got my multi-tool right here.
Well, anyway,
I think that's one of Bill Burr's bits. One of his best bits is like, if you're preparing for the worst and stocking up on food and all this stuff, unless you're also buying a gun, you're just storing things for the most powerful guy on your block.
Right. I mean, I think we all have played Oregon Trail, and we all did the thing where instead of buying any food, we bought as many oxen and as many bullets as we could so we could go as fast as we could and just hunted whenever we need food.
Exactly.
Right. Even in the old days, we were min-maxing games like crazy.
Well, always be reloading.
Right, right.
Check your corners.
one of the things in the class that someone brought up was like, what do you do for money? Is like, is money even gonna make sense if you're trying to escape San Francisco? Or like, is there a point when people stop taking money? And they were saying that in New Orleans after Katrina, and this actual bit I thought was the most useful, was like discussing how it is in places where it actually, where the rule of law actually did break down to some degree. And so they were saying that after essentially about a week, money was not useful as a tool to get stuff unless it was a lot of money. For the most part, people would rather trade for things after about a week. So I thought that was an interesting bit of information, because some people were saying like, how do you keep money? Are you going to keep money in these kind of secret places around the city? Cause that seems like a bad idea. It's like, you're essentially just throwing that money away because anyone can find it. And one of the people suggested, oh, well, yeah, you should use Bitcoins because they're not traceable, and they'll be around, and they're electronic, so they don't take up any space. And I'm not so sure about that, given what you told me about this last Friday.
Oh yeah, only one of the largest Bitcoin exchanges in the world shut down. Well, I mean, aside from that, the idea of putting your money into Bitcoins for a survival situation is dumb. If you have no power, you have no internet.
You have no Bitcoins. Right.
Yeah, your Bitcoins are useless. And apparently, even if you have power and you have internet, your Bitcoins are still useless if you put them in Mt. Gox.
Oh, yeah.
Because they lost $460 million worth of Bitcoins, just gone.
Oh, my gosh. That's so many Bitcoins, so much money. And then it's not that it's gone and they're like, we'll try and work our way out to figure it out. They pretty much, no, because that's their money. That's how banks work. They work on kind of holding that money for you while you do other transactions and taking some amount of a cut of when you transact in and out. And that is a big enough loss that they declared bankruptcy and were like, oh, sorry. And now anyone that had money in that exchange is just screwed.
Because there's no FDIC for Bitcoin. You're not insured.
Yep. The downside for, trying out these kind of new and fancy currencies is that sometimes they don't work.
Nope.
But one kind of saving grace about it is the article that we'll link mentions that the problem that caused the theft, or at least that they're able to figure out, is not based on a flaw in Bitcoin's kind of setup or methodology or anything like that, but just based on Mt. Gox's exchange model about how you transfer money in and out of it, is that there was a bug in that code. And so there was some way that people were either skimming money out of it or duplicating transactions or otherwise taking money out of the system, which is a thing that happens to like banks and ATMs, not, I wouldn't say regularly, but it's not new to those kinds of systems. But on the scale of a Bitcoin, it apparently is not that well secured, and it's still a problem. And you know, as you were saying, you know, there's no FDIC, so when that money's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a case of bad coding.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where given enough time, given enough people that that value the security built into it, it would probably be fixed. It would probably be something that's just as solid as the current... Oh, God. The current financial institutions. Too big to fail.
Ouch.
Yeah, ow. Anyway,
I will say it's interesting to see Russia's economy already taking a hit. They've been in Ukraine for like 3 days, and they're already taking big losses. Like, hey, wait a minute, guys. What are we? Let's just take a step back here.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing. I mean, one thing that I'd heard about that was that I guess at some point. Certain things are essentially off limits for buying on the internet, so you have to buy them locally, and that in itself is causing supply issues and you know, obviously reducing consumer confidence, which is a major factor for most like financial indicators at a place or whatever. And so it's, yeah, that's all not good. Pretty much. The Ukraine thing, really not a thing. That should not be a thing.
Definitely. And one of the things I find interesting about it is the Russian media is all state-owned. So right. They're putting out their propaganda.
Yep.
Which we're seeing, they're using like 19th century tactics or 20th century tactics of propaganda. And it's like, well, there's other people with cameras. There's the internet. You're not going to be able to trick people into believing what you're saying.
Well, I think the major issue with that is that they are showing, at least on CNN, which is unfortunately all that's playing in my break room for the last 2 days, but all they're playing is you know, the parroting of whatever state leader said this or that, and whenever they show anything from the Russian side, it's like, how do you not put a big old disclaimer on all of those posts from a news perspective? And it's, you know, that is more of a failing of news as journalism, at least in from CNN's point of view. It's like, this is clearly news for entertainment's sake, and so that's kind of a bummer.
But, well, trying to put out the idea that they're sending in troops to stop ultranationalist Nazis is freaking ridiculous.
Wow.
Wow. And then saying we're not actually there.
Yikes. Anyway.
It's like, no, there's guys right there. Look, you can see them.
Well, from propaganda films to... film festivals. San Jose's film festival is this week, and I don't know if they're doing anything specifically propaganda oriented, but the Cinequest Film Festival starts this week, and it's always a favorite of mine because they're almost always very independent films. There's always some that are kind of they were. Big budget bankroll, but then for whatever reason they got held up in the distribution step, and so some are being shopped around to film festivals. So like there's one tomorrow that I'm gonna see. I think it's called Hunting Elephants. I think,
yeah, not 100%. Is that the Patrick Stewart one?
Yes, so Patrick, yeah. Stewart is in it, and it's billed as a heist film but also as a comedy. I have pretty high hopes for it. So there's that. But What's interesting is that they do have a lot. They do have a short program, which is good. So they'll take, you know, short films and kind of crush them together along a theme, and those have been kind of really interesting. And they usually have an animated shorts one, which I think I'm gonna try and go to. But they also have a lot of interesting documentaries. Like I saw one about. And this was a couple years ago. There was one about the cars in Cuba and how everyone because they can't import from the U.S. because of the embargo. So there are a lot of U.S. cars that were made in like the 40s that they're still running. They've essentially rebuilt so much of those engines that they're not. You know, nothing is original anymore, but they keep them running, and that's why kind of it looks that way. And that was a really interesting documentary. But this year, the documentary ones, one of the ones that I'm going to go see is it's called Sex Ed, and it's kind of compiling sex ed films from like the beginning of sex ed films. So it should be, that one should be pretty hilarious. I'm pretty excited for that one. But it's such a nice thing to see in San Jose, to see that kind of film festival culture. Because I remember when I lived in San Luis Obispo, their film festival was also really fun. And one of they would always have like a Western that they would throw on as one of the things. And I really, I guess, still enjoy that kind of Western mystique for things. And so one of the things I'm excited for the San Jose Cinequest Festival is next Wednesday. There's a film that is essentially Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, but done as a samurai film.
Nice.
I'm very excited for that because I love the opposite of that. So The Seven Samurai, the Akira Kurosawa film, was turned into Magnificent Seven, which is far and away one of my favorite Westerns. And I remember when I saw The Seven Samurai for the first time, I was just blown away by, you know, like the source material and how good it was. And I love Unforgiven as a movie. I like to think of Unforgiven as one of the last... I mean, it's really one of the last... really good Westerns. And I mean, it's done from the point of view of Clint Eastwood's character, who's, you know, he'd been in Westerns forever. And so it's a, like, you know, it's the last thing that this aging cowboy is gonna do. And to think of that as being echoed back into a samurai film, I'm very excited for it.
Yeah, I would say Magnificent Seven and Unforgiven, two of my favorite Westerns.
Yeah.
James Coburn is great in The Magnificent Seven.
Right, the knife throwing.
Exactly.
Guy. Yeah. Oh, when they pick him up and he's just like the total drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And he can barely stand, and the guy's like, I'm going to fight you. I'm going to fight you. You know, I can beat you. And he's stumbling around, but when it's game time. Oh,
yeah. He bring a knife to a gunfight and right. Wins.
Yeah.
But Unforgiven, just that movie has so much rage in it.
Yep.
It's so good.
Yeah. So I'm pretty excited for that as and that one's at the California Theater. Another one at the California Theater in San Jose is I think it's The Hands of Orlok. I think that's the name of it. It's a silent film. It's one of those like semi horror kind of films, like I think it's the Hands of a Pianist, it's like the hands of a serial killer were cut off and given to a pianist. I don't know exactly what the thing is. It's a little confusing, especially because it's a silent film, but the thing that they do with silent films at the California Theater is that they have the Wurlitzer organ come up and someone plays a score live to the movie. which if you've never seen, I 100% guarantee you, you will be blown away by if you ever do it. They do it at the Castro in San Francisco every once in a while, and they don't do it often enough in San Jose. I think they do it for CineQuest every year, and they may do it one other time for another kind of regular like event kind of thing. But seeing the amount of kind of energy and dexterity to play essentially for the length of a movie, to play, you know, the keyboard for that amount of time and have it in time with, you know, what's happening on the screen and everything else is amazing. It's totally worth doing.
So if you're in the San Jose area or within a short drive, go check it out.
Not sponsored by CineQuest, unfortunately. Maybe we can work something out, CineQuest. You know, you plug us, we plug you. I don't know. The one thing that I know is that we don't go to enough of the movies to warrant getting a movie pass. Like, I think the movies end up being like $10-ish per showing, and the bottom level pass gets you free entrance to as many as you can see, but it still costs like $150. So that would be, you know, 15 movies, which is like a movie a day for the run. And I don't know, I work. So it gets in the way, I guess. I mean, maybe if I...
Movie vacation.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to see like a couple movies a day or do some other kind of thing, like a movie vacation. But what's interesting is, I guess because they sell those kinds of passes, they sell tickets for the individual movies, and they don't know how many passes will come in. So sometimes they will, I guess, oversell the shows in a very airline style kind of thing. But there's no refund if the screening is full. So that's a real bummer. You got to get there. You got to be in line early in order to get a good seat. And they're taking another queue from the airlines. And there's actually I think they even call it this. They call it a line jumper pass. So you can spend an extra, I want to say it's $100, and then you get to stand in the short line of people that they let in first. Yeah, I'm not going to be doing that. I don't believe in cutting the line, so that's kind of a bummer.
Not a thing.
Yeah, there's a lot that's good and a couple things that are bad in everything is what you can learn. Well, one thing that I hope is all good is also this Sunday. The return of Cosmos is coming this Sunday to Fox, of all things. I'm very surprised.
But, yeah.
Fox is putting it in after, I want to say it's at like 9 at night, which is after their normal, or that's normally their like animation domination kind of primetime spot. So I don't know if enough stuff are in reruns, they're shoehorning it in or what, but
I think they've been working on this long enough and probably dumped enough money into it that they're, you know, they want to give it some play.
They're eager to get it on the air. Well, hopefully they give it, you know, an almost human level of a run.
And I highly doubt they're going to cancel it.
Okay, well, I hope they at least run the entire series and it gets some eyeballs, because it's hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's a fairly outspoken kind of science and astronomy advocate. So I think it's got a lot of kind of good stuff behind it. And the original Cosmos that was hosted by kind of Carl Sagan was really kind of a big deal. I mean, people watched it. So I'm hoping people watch this. I think especially because it has so much potential with the amount of space research and especially astrophotography that has come out recently that they can do a lot with the show. I'm pretty excited for that kind of thing.
Science, bitch.
Yeah, if nothing told you science should come back, it's all the Academy Awards that Gravity won on Sunday.
Yeah. Which I rewatched after the Academy Awards. I rewatched Gravity.
Yeah.
On the small on my TV instead of on the big screen.
Sure.
It's a good movie.
That's excellent. I'm really glad that it holds up on a smaller screen because I saw it in IMAX 3D, and I think if I gave it anything, it would have been that you didn't need to see it in 3D to really appreciate it. But seeing it in IMAX, especially when, you know, there's like the parts of the debris cloud essentially coming mm-hmm. through, it's just amazing, just harrowing how that happened.
Which so, it was that part is it's so good. And yeah. it was still good on the TV, but it wasn't quite as jaw dropping as on the big screen. But I mean that's what movies are made for. They're made for the theater.
Right. Right. Which is, you know, the other reason that I love going to Cinequest. It's that a lot of these are movies that probably wouldn't get wide distribution, and so they would depend on something like a smaller run, like a Netflix or a Hulu Plus or whoever to pick them up. And seeing those kinds of things, you know, films made for the big screen, on the big screen, is great. So highly recommend Cinequest. And then if you have nothing else to do on Sunday because you're not at Cinequest, definitely watch Cosmos. That's a new thing.
Yeah, Cosmos, and I believe it's on at the same time as HBO's True Detective, which you can watch at another time or, you know, watch it. Find HBO on your TV. If you don't have it, find someone who's got an HBO account you can borrow. Download it illegally if you have to. Watch that show.
Oh, that was the other thing. So HBO Go, which is their streaming kind of thing, just came to PlayStation 3, of all things, today.
Oh, congratulations. You're only like 3 years behind Xbox.
Yeah, Sony. I'm all over it. I'm all over it.
Now that your machine is obsolete, let's roll out this nice feature.
Right, exactly. Well, I have to prep for probably every day of going to Cinequest for the next week. So I'm going to be doing that, and we'll have a lot to talk about next week. Again, if you are interested in helping make one of our shows feel extra special and want to be a guest, let us know. Brendan, do you have anything to add?
No.
Right on. Well, I will talk to you next week.
Till next time.